Now we come to the last lecture of the series, 11th of June, 1908. Rudolf Steiner starts by saying that we have, in our the last lectures of our members' evenings, led before you certain visual, certain aspects, all which point to the fact that there exists mysterious working together between the human being and spiritual worlds. Spiritual beings, which actually are continuously around us, and not only are around us, but are continually in a certain connection, also pass through us, with whom we live continuously. We must, however, not imagine that only in those, one might say, coarse connections, which we have mentioned in the last lectures, does a relationship develop between the human being and spiritual beings of his environmenting world, but also through the manifold, more of the human thought circle, deeds and organizations, man forms himself a connection between the human beings and the spiritual world. We have, in both of the preceding lectures, had to point to a certain connection of subordinate spiritual beings. But we know, out of earlier lectures, that we are concerned with spiritual beings who stand above the human being, and that also connections and relationships exist between the human being and elevated spiritual beings. We have mentioned that there exists elevated spiritual beings who, not as the human being consist, which cannot, not like the human being who consists out of a physical body, ether body, astral body, etc., upwards, but who, as a lowest member, have an ether body. These beings, so to say, dwell around us, but for the ordinary gaze, they are not visible, because their bodily nature is of a fine ethereal nature, so that the human glance looks right through them. And then we come to still higher spiritual beings, whose lowest member is the astral body, which thus offer a still less thick corporeality to the human being. All these beings stand in a certain connection to the human being, and what today is the main thing today is that man can absolutely do something in order to come into some connection. Man here can do something in his life here upon the earthly scene of action, and when he does whatever he does of certain things, he comes to a quite definite connections to such beings. Indeed, according to how human beings here upon the earth do this thing or do that thing for their life relationships, according to that, they place themselves always into connections to higher worlds. Even though this may seem so very astonishing for the so-called man of the intellectual age, who is not at all, doesn't understand anything about the much deep truths of life. Let's take, for example, beings who, as their lowest corporeality, have an etheric body, who live with this fine etheric body around us, who surround us, and who send down their workings and manifestations, revelations, to us down here. Let's place such beings in spirit before our soul and ask ourselves, can man do something here on this earth situation, on this earth round? Or better, do men of do men at all times have a possibility of building a bridge in order that these beings could come to a connection through which they can have a much more intensive working upon the whole human being? And the answer is indeed, at all times, human beings did that sort of thing. We must deepen ourselves in many perceptions and ideas which we could take up from the last lectures if we want to make a significant clear thought about this bridge. This bridge to build towards being such a connection to make them work much more intensively upon the whole human being. We imagine, we represent to ourselves that these beings live, so to say, out of the spiritual worlds, and from there they stretch forth, as it were, their ether body. They don't need any physical body as man has, but there exists a physical corporeality through which, so to say, they can set in connection their ether body with our earthly sphere. A earthly corporeality which we, so to say, can erect upon the earth, place upon our earth, and which forms a band of attraction so that these beings with their ether bodies can come down to this earthly corporeality and take their occasion to maintain themselves among human beings. After describing something that he has in his mind, the usual Steiner idea, and has this in his mind in an abstract way, now he's going to tell you, such occasions for spiritual beings to maintain themselves among human beings are, for example, the temple of the Greek architecture, the Gothic dome. Epstein had first started off by making this sentence, then the last paragraph, which I shared with you, which obviously made no sense to you, was purely an abstract description of something you didn't know what I was talking about. But you know now what I was talking about when I tell you what he's talking about. Namely, he's talking about the places in which you have architectural places of temple and Gothic domes. Quite right for Steiner to do this when he has an audience in front of him. He's there. The idea is in his head. Then it makes sense for him to, in an abstract way, describe the idea because he's present with the audience. There's a telepathic communication, and it would sort of perhaps assist in some sort of building up some sort of atmosphere in which the final idea, namely, I'm talking now about Greek temples or Gothic domes, that makes sense, and that's valid. But when it's put down on a printed transcript, and a person reads it, well, as he reads it, his mind gets confused. He doesn't know what you're talking about. Then he comes to it. You see, that's one of the reasons why I imagine Rudolf Steiner didn't want these lectures to be presented in the form in which he spoke them. And that's why he was against it, not because he didn't want people to know about it. It's just the form, the whole form he knew needed to be recast. He didn't have time to do it. A person like Rick Mansell comes along and tries to recast it, tries to put some life into it, some meaning. People object. It's not what Rudolf Steiner said. Let's go back to the text. Now, when we take those forms of physical reality with their lines and force relationships as they exist in a temple, also as they exist in a sculptural artistic work, and when you place these into our earthly sphere, then they form an opportunity that, according to these force relationships, the etheric bodies of these beings conform and press into from all sides. They press into and conform to all sides into these artistic works erected by man. An art is a true and real connecting bridge between the human being and the spiritual world. Right up to those artistic forms which are formed in a space way. Right up to that, do we have upon the earth physical corporealities to which beings with etheric bodies can sink themselves down. So now he's talked about beings with etheric bodies. Now he's going to talk about beings which as their lowest corporeality have the astral body. They need, however, something here different upon the earth to act as a connection between the spiritual world and our earth. And these are the musical arts, the phonetic arts, a space which is streamed through from the sounds of music is an opportunity in which the easily mobile in this conformed astral body of higher beings can live themselves out in this space. There we get the arts, and that which they are for human beings have and are a very real significance. They form magnetic forces of attraction for spiritual beings who, according to their mission, according to their task, have and want to do something with the human being. There, with that, there deepens itself our feelings in relationship to human artistic creation and to human artistic perception when we look upon things in this way. Still more can our feeling deepen itself when we take into ourself from the standpoint of spiritual science the human source of artistic creation. And with that, the artistic enjoyment. When you consider this from the standpoint of spiritual science, you can increase your enjoyment for the creators of the art and for the enjoyers of the art. And when we want to do that, we must perhaps, in a somewhat amplified way, consider the different forms of consciousness of the human being. We have there indeed, according to various aims and goals, pointed to the fact that we, in the waking human being, have before us the physical body, the astral, the physical body, the ether body, the astral body, and the ego. That we, in the sleeping man, have before us, lying in the bed, physical body and ether body. And outside the physical body and ether body, there you have the ego and the astral body. It is good when we more or less in a much more amplified way consider these two segments of such a interchanging consciousness which occurs for every human being within 24 hours. We have in the first place in the human being the physical body, then the ether or life body, then that which we, in the coarse word of the coarse sense of the word, call the astral body, we have in the first place in the human being the physical body, fine. Then we have the ether or the life body. Now we have the soul body. The soul body, which is a coarse aspect, a coarse way of referring to the astral body. This soul body, which belongs to the astral body, but which is united with the ether body. This soul body is that member of the human being which the animal has here also in the physical life here upon the physical plane. Hence we know that with these three members of the human being there is united and you can read that in my book, Theosophy, that is united that which one is collects together under the designation of ego. And that which we collect together under the designation of the ego, that actually is a three-membered being. The sentient soul, intellectual gemut soul, and consciousness soul. And we then know that, again, the consciousness soul is united with that which we call spirit self or manas. If we place this more amplified membering of the human being in front of us, then we are able to say the following. What we call the sentient soul, and which absolutely otherwise belongs to the astral body, and is also of an astral nature, that separates itself out when man goes to sleep every evening. But a portion of the soul body nevertheless remains behind in the ether body, united in the ether body which lies in the bed. And in the main, there separates itself out the sentient soul, intellectual soul, and consciousness soul. For the first time, I've got Rick Mansell speaking clarification of something which has confused me for years. For years, Rudolf Steiner talked about the astral body. The astral body leaves the physical etheric at sleep. But here, for the first time, he indicates that actually a part of the astral body, which he calls the sentient body, that remains behind in bed. He doesn't say the sentient body remains united with the ether body, but he says a part of the sentient body. I want to deduce that another part of the sentient body goes out with the astral body. So, what is the distinction between these two parts of the sentient body? Or could it be a mistake in the transcript? The Rudolf Steiner said the whole sentient body, and which is a part of the astral body. Could that what it meant? I don't know. We've learned something anyway. I hope you have. Go back to the text. Rosen continues. In the day-wake human being, all this is connected with each other, and through that, it works that also out in the human being. Thus, that which occurs in the physical body works upon the whole inwardness, upon the sentient soul, upon the intellectual soul, and also upon the consciousness soul. That which in the ordinary actually correctly, really disordered and chaotic life, that which works ordinarily upon the human being as an disordered and chaotic life, namely, the disordered impressions which he takes up from morning to evening. Just think for the moment what sort of impressions that you take up when you go through the hustle and bustle of a great city. All these impressions, which continue themselves into all the members, which are united with the physical and ether body in the day-waking consciousness. In the night, this inwardness, this sentient soul, intellectual soul, and consciousness soul, this inwardness is in the astral world, and it fetches out from there the forces, the harmonies, which during the day-wake life are lost because of the chaotic impressions of the day. That is which one in a more comprehensive sense of the human being calls the ego soul. This ego soul is in a much more ordered spiritual world than this ego soul is, that which you call the ego soul, and this ego soul is during the waking day. In the morning, this soul inwardness emanates out of this spirituality and dives down into the threefold corporeality, into the physical body, ether body, and that part of the astral body which is actually united with the ether body, and which also in the night is connected with the ether body. Now you see here he doesn't call it, he calls it now the part of the astral body, meaning the sentient body. So before, when the transcript said it's a part of the sentient body, I'm confused whether it was a transcript. And here it seems obviously it means a sentient body. And then you back to the text. When man would never sleep, that means he would never be able to fetch new strengthening forces out of the spiritual world. Then ultimately, that which lives in his physical body and which permeates his physical body as forces, that would more and more be undermined. Through the fact, however, that every morning a strong inwardness dives down into the forces of the physical body, there continuously comes a new ordering, one might say, a rebirth of forces enter into this physical body. Hence, the human soul element brings something for the bodily members out of the spiritual world. Something which works when the soul inwardness, which is in the night outside, that brings it back to the external work instrument, which every morning when it comes down and wakes up. Good heavens. Continue. What now in the interworking between the soul inwardness and the actual physical instrument occurs, that can, when the human being is receptive for the taking up of the harmonies of the spiritual world in the night, that can permeate the physical body in its forces, not in its substances, but permeate the physical body in its forces with those forces which one might call the space forces. Because the human being in our present culture is so estranged from the spiritual world, there come to him these space forces very little in evidence. There, where the soul inwardness impinges against the thickest member of the human body, there must the forces be which are brought with them must be so strong, if they are to live themselves out, express themselves in the robust physical body. In ancient cultural epochs, the soul inwardness brought with them the soul impulses and permeated the physical body, and there human beings then perceived that through the physical space, according to all sides, there were always forces which permeate the space, the spatial aspect, in all directions. That you don't have merely empty space, but space which is permeated by forces on all sides. Now there exists a feeling for this division of forces in space, and that causes the relationships which have just now being depicted. You must be able to make this present to yourself through an example. Just imagine a painter who belonged to the still great times of art, when there was still present a real feeling for those forces working in space. With such a painter, you could see how he paints a group of three angels in space. You stand before this picture, and you have the direct feeling that these three angels could not be able to fall, would not fall down. It's obvious that they soar and hold themselves up because they mutually support themselves through the forces working in space. Those human beings who have acquired through themselves, through that interworking between the soul inwardness and the physical body, who've acquired for themselves this inner dynamic, for them is the feeling present that it must be just as the painter painted it, that the three angels can hold themselves together in space. You'll particularly find this in many of the ancient painters, less with the more modern painters. Now, you might value Böcklin as very high as you can, but that form which soars over his Pieta, that calls in every human being the feeling that in any moment, these forms above the Pieta might plump themselves down. They really can't hold themselves in space. Now, all these forces going to and fro in space, which a human being can feel really existing in space, these are realities. And out of this feeling for space, there proceeded all of architecture. Real, true architecture springs forth out of nothing other than that man, in the lines which are already there in space, they insert stones or tiles, in which you have to do nothing else other than merely making visible that which already is spiritually distributed in space. All you do is stuff materiality into these existing forces in space. To the most purest way, in the most purest way, there was present this feeling for space in those Greek architects who brought in his temple all those forms to representation which live in space and which one can feel in space. This simple relationship which the pillar carries, either the horizontal or the inclined lines of the body, that is a representation of forces which exist, spiritual forces which exist in space. And the whole Greek temple is nothing else other than a filling out of that which exists already as the lines of force in space by filling this out with materiality. For this reason, the Greek temple is the purest architectonic thought. The Greek temple is crystallized space. And so strange it might appear to the modern human being, the Greek temple is, because it is a put-together physical corporeality out of thoughts, that has given the opportunity of those forms which the Greeks knew as their god forms, gave them, these forms of gods, the opportunity with their ether bodies to really contact, to touch, and to be able to live in to these lines of space which have been entrusted to them. Thus, it is more than a mere phrase when it is said that the Greek temple is a dwelling place of the god. For the person who has a real feeling for such things, the Greek temple has the characteristic which one can depict for oneself by saying that the Greek temple doesn't need any human being to look upon it. It doesn't need a human being to go inside this temple. Just conceive of yourself the Greek temple standing there alone, and surrounding it there's no human being at all. Then it is what it should be in the most intensive way. Then it is the refuge of the god who wants to live in it, because the god knows the forms and he can live in because the forms of the god can live in this refuge of the temple. Only in this way do you really understand Greek architecture, the purest architecture in the world. For the person who has a real feeling for such things, the Greek temple has the characteristic which one can depict for oneself by saying that the Greek temple doesn't need any human being to look upon it. It doesn't need a human being to go inside this temple. Just conceive of yourself the Greek temple standing there alone, and surrounding it there's no human being at all. Then it is what it should be in the most intensive way. Then it is the refuge of the god who wants to live in it, because the god knows the forms and he can live in because the forms of the god can live in this refuge of the temple. Only in this way do you really understand Greek architecture, the purest architecture in the world. Now, when you come to the Egyptian architecture, like the pyramids, for example, there you have something quite different. We are now able just only to touch upon these things. There are the space relationships. The space relationships are so ordered that they, in their forms, point the way to souls who are soaring upwards to the spiritual worlds. Out of the paths which the soul takes in order to enter into the spiritual world, out of the physical world, there we have expressed in the forms which are given in the Egyptian pyramid. And so we have, in every kind of architectonic, something which thoughts which can only be grasped, which can be grasped only out of spirituality, out of spiritual knowledge. Now, when we come to the Roman architecture, which has the round Norman arches, the round arches, which, for example, so ordered church structures, these Roman architecture with the round arches, have so ordered the structures that we have the whole church structure is so constructed and ordered that we have the central aisle or nave. Then you have the side aisle, the side aisles. And then you have the transept. And then you have an apse. So the whole has a cross form. And above you have the dome. There you have the space thoughts grown out of the grave place, the burial place. The Roman building cannot be thought in the same way as the Greek temple structure. The Greek temple is the dwelling place of the god. The Roman building is to be thought in no other way than that it presents a graveyard, a grave place. The crypt belongs there. Not representing that human beings are going to stand there in direct living, in direct life, but it belongs to it that it is a place which draws together all those feelings which are connected with the preservation and with the guardianship of the dead. But now, in the Gothic structure, you have again something different. So true as it is that the Greek temple can be conceived of as being without any human souls, nevertheless it is dwelt in, it is populated, because it is the dwelling place of the god. Just as that is true, so true it is that the Gothic church, with the pointed Gothic art, which finishes itself above, cannot be thought without having within it the faithful community. It's not complete without the faithful congregation. When it stands there alone, it's not really complete. People belong inside it. People whose hands are folded, just as the pointed arch, the Gothic pointed arch, is folded. Only then is the thing completed, when the space is filled with the feelings of the devoted faithful. These are the forces working in us, which can be perceived in the physical body as feeling oneself inserted into space. The true artist feels space in that sort of way, and he conforms it in an architectonic way. Thus, we have dealing with the sort of bodily forces, the forces of the body which can be felt in space. Now let's proceed towards the ether body. Here we have again something which the soul inwardness of the night acquires for itself in the spiritual world and brings back with itself when it again slips back into the ether body. What we in this way have expressed as an ether body, that which expresses itself in this way in the ether body, that soul inwardness which takes the forces of the spiritual world from the night and immerses itself again in the ether body, what is expressed in this way is perceived by the real sculptor, who then impregnates it into living forms. There you're not dealing with a space thought, but you have the tendency more and more to show and to configure the living form which is given to it in nature. What the Greek artist more knew of it, for example, in Zeus, that is it what he brought forth out of the spiritual world, which is invigorated, enlivened, and perceived when it comes together with the ether body. Now we have characterized sculpture. Now, you can continue, Rovsani continues, further there occurs further such an interaction with that which we call the soul body. When the soul inwardness comes together with the soul body, there arises in this same way a feeling for how lines are produced, for the first elements of painting. And through the fact that in the morning the sentient soul unites itself with the soul body and permeates the soul body, there arises the feeling for the harmony of colors. I believe now, Rick Mansell speaking, I believe now it's confirmed the fact there was a mistake in the transcript when they said a part of the soul body is left behind in bed. It should have been said a part of the astral body, namely the soul body. This confirms it. Okay. Now Rudolf continues. So we have in the first place the three artistic forms. Architecture, connected with the physical body. Sculpture, connected with the ether body. Painting, connected with the soul body. And the sentient soul working into the soul body. These are the three art forms which take their material out of the external world. Now Rufsari continues. Through the fact that the intellectual or Gemütsoul every night flows into the astral world, there proceeds something else. When we, in the sense of spiritual science, use the expression intellectual soul, we must not conceive of the dry prosaic intellect which one thinks of when in ordinary life one speaks of the intellect. Verstand, for the intellect, for the spiritual science, is for spiritual science the sense for harmony. Harmony which cannot be incorporated in external substances. It's the sense for experienced inner harmony. And because that is the way which we use the intellect, the experienced inner harmony, for that reason we also say intellectual Gemütsoul. When now every night the intellectual or Gemütsoul dives down into the harmonies of the astral world, and then every morning becomes conscious of that in the astral body, in that same astral body which indeed goes back again, but which, however, during the night time is not conscious of its inwardness, then there occurs the following. In the night, the intellectual Gemütsoul lives in that which we have called the sphere harmonies, the inner conformity to law of the spiritual world, those sphere harmonies which were pointed to in the ancient Pythagorean school. And what person who can perceive into the spiritual world perceives as the relationships of the great spiritual world? Also Goethe pointed to that when Faust, at the beginning of his poem, is transposed into heavens and is characterized by the fact that he says that the sun sounds according to the ancient way in the song of its brother spheres and completes its prescribed journey with the Donnergang, the sound of thunder. And it remains in a picture when in the second time, when again Faust is lifted up into the spiritual world, Faust uses the poem, referring to the fact that for spiritual ears, when the new day is born, there are sounds are heard about the wheels of Phoebus as it runs roughly through, how it brings the light and it sounds and the eye lights and the ear is astonished, etc., etc., etc. This means that the soul lives during the night in these sphere harmonies, and these sphere harmonies ignite themselves insofar as the astral body becomes aware of itself. In the creative musician, we have no other process than the perception of the nightly consciousness in its memories during the day, memories of the astral experiences, or particularly the experiences of the intellectual Gemütsoul. Everything which mankind knows as a musical art are expressions, impregnations of that which is unconsciously experienced in the sphere harmonies. And to be musically gifted means nothing else than to have an astral body which during the day condition is perceptible, receptive for that which goes through, which permeates through it the whole night through. To be unmusical means that the astral body is in such a condition that such a memory cannot occur. It is the sounding in of a spiritual world which man experiences in musical art. Of course, the musical art is that which creates into our physical world something which can only be ignited or enlivened by in the astral body. Hence, because of that, I said that musical art brings you together in connection with those beings who have, as their lowest member, the astral body. It's with those beings man lives during the night. Man experiences their deeds in the sphere harmony and expresses itself during the day through his earthly music. So that in the earthly music you have a shadow picture of the sphere harmonies. And in so far as that which is the element of these spiritual beings inserts itself into this earthly sphere that waves through and permeates and lives through our earthly sphere, they have opportunity to again immerse their astral bodies in this ocean of musical workings. And so there has been created through art, through the musical art, a bridge between these beings and the human being. And now we come to the conscious soul. What happens to the conscious soul during the night? It perceives the words of the spiritual world. It receives whispered into it revelations which it can only receive out of the spiritual world. Words are whispered into it. When these words are brought into day consciousness, then they appear as the forces, the fundamental forces of poetry. So poetry is a shadow picture of what the consciousness soul has experienced during the night. Now we understand how man has his union with the higher worlds in the five arts: architecture, sculpture, painting, music, and poetry, as revelations, shadowings of the spiritual reality brought into existence here upon the earth. To be sure, this is only the case when the art really lifts itself up above mere external sense perception. In that sort of coarse, naturalistic art, where you just imitate what's outside it, there's nothing of that which is brought forth out of the spiritual worlds. And that today, on many domains, we have such an external art, which only wants to imitate that which is outside it, is only a proof for the fact how men in our present age have lost the connection with the divine spiritual worlds. Man, whose interest goes into, all his interest goes into the external physical world, in that which is provided by the external senses, works over through this mere only interest on the external physical world, he so works over his astral corporeality that it becomes blind and deaf in the night when it is in the spiritual worlds. There, when he comes up to the spiritual world, after being the astral body being exposed purely to physical external worlds, there this astral body can hear the most wonderful harmony of the spheres. The sounds of the soul can be whispered into him, some high tones, Nevertheless, that sort of astral body will bring nothing back with it into the day life. And then man will mock about all the idealistic art, about spiritual art, and say art is just there merely to photograph the external reality. True artist says something different. He says that when I hear resounding in myself the sounds of the orchestra, I then hear speaking in myself the sounds of the primal music which resounded already when there was no human ear there to hear it. They also say in the sounds which exist in a symphony there is a knowledge of the spiritual worlds which is much higher, much more significant than that which can be logically proved by logical arguments. Both these expressions were produced by Richard Wagner. He insisted that true art must be a lifting up from the external sense world. Wagner didn't want to create forms upon the stage like everyday human beings. Since he selects mythical forms, he seeks for the superhuman in the human. Wagner was quite young. They stood before him Shakespeare and Beethoven. Shakespeare, he had forms which on the stage they act, and words in this connection are also actions. They act out that which cannot be externally presented in space. The soul's whole scale from pain and suffering right up to pleasure and happiness is felt and perceived when this or that nuance of action is brought forth. Shakespeare's dramatic is something which externalizes something which exists inwardly. And man can to the highest degree surmise that which lives in the soul as this person produces this action. And in the symphony, Richard Wagner saw that which is in the soul produced in the whole scale of perceptions, right up from pleasure and pain, in all its nuances, right up the whole range of our feelings. It's as if that which occurs inwardly bursts itself out in artistic creation and pours out into the Ninth Symphony. Wagner tried to unite Shakespeare and Beethoven, that the inner expresses itself in tone and at the same time flows into action. The profane speech was not enough for him. That's the expression for processes upon the physical plane. That speech which can be found in the sounds of song could be the medium of expression for that which transcends the physical human as a superhuman. Richard Wagner wanted to bring together in a unity that which lives in the totality. He didn't want to be purely a musician, not a dramatist, not a poet. But everything that comes running down out of the spiritual worlds were his means for uniting in the physical plane something which was still higher, because Wagner had an inkling of that which man will experience when it more and more lives itself out into the coming epoch in which spirit self or manus will unite with that which man has brought with him since ancient times. The soul in the spirit self manus principle will immerse itself fully in the spiritual worlds. In a certain way, the arts are absolutely the forerunners of the revelation of the spiritual in the sense world. We can see that through art, man can do something which enables the gods to live in the earthly sphere. For the musical poetical, it was first Richard Wagner in whom the new star rose, which sent the light of spiritual life to the earth. Everything which meets us from the outside world can become a mirror for the soul. Just as in centuries ago, in every key, every door lock was an image of what was felt by the artisan. Today we get a feel of what form should be like. You'll build railway stations different. You'll make locomotives more architectonic. Realize what has to be placed to the left and what has to be placed to the right. When man will learn how in the externality the inner being can be expressed, then we shall again get a culture. It is true there were times when there did not exist the Roman architecture, when there did not exist the Gothic architecture. That which was to be represent the new coming culture, those who carried the future culture in their souls, they gathered together in the catacombs of the ancient Roman city. That which lived in them, which could only be engraved in meager forms in the ancient earth caves, what you find in the coffins of the dead, there was the first dawning, and there is something which then appears to us in the Roman arch, in the Roman pillar, in the apsis. There was carried out, the thought was carried out into the world. If the earth first Christians had not carried the thought in their soul, then they would not confront us today that which has become world culture. The theosophist feels himself only then as a theosophist when he is conscious of the fact that he in his soul, like the early Christians, carrying a future culture. Let other people say to him, "What then have you done?" Then he says to himself, "Indeed, you can ask yourself the questions, what did the catacomb Christians do? And what came out of that?" If we will attempt that which lives as a lesser perception impulse in our soul, if when we sit together we can take this lesser perception impulse, this sort of lesser feeling, and expand it in the spirit, just as the Christian thought had been able to expand itself to the arch wonders of the later churches. Just think that in such hours when we are together, we can expand outwards, we can carry out into the world. Then we have that impulse in us, which we ought to have when we are conscious of the fact that theosophy is not some sort of Liebhaberei, some sort of fancy thing for single human beings who sit down there. But theosophy is something which should be carried out into the world. The souls who sit here in their bodies, they become, when they will again reincarnate, you here or sitting here now, souls, your souls will again be reincarnate. And you will find, already realize when you come back and reincarnate, that which now lives in your soul. Such thoughts we take with us. When we, for a season, have come together for the last time for a season, and we work over the spiritual scientific thoughts of the winter. Let's transform these spiritual scientific thoughts, so transform them that they can work in us as an impulse for culture. Let us attempt so to permeate our soul with perceptions and feelings, and let us permit us to meet the sunshine of summer, which comes to us from the outside in the physical, which shows to us the working cosmic force. Then will our souls more and more maintain the soul mood and be capable of that which is experienced in the spiritual worlds to be carried out into the external world. This is something which belongs to the development of theosophists. So we shall again come a stage further when we take such feelings and perception with us together into the strengthening of the summer. And here ends a very remarkable 11-course lecture series.